I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Do you have friends who are members of the other party? More and more, we are walling ourselves off from people whose politics don't match our own. This has led to misunderstandings and misconceptions highlighted in a study titled The Parties in Our Heads. The authors asked Republicans what percent of the Democratic Party is black. The answer they got was 46%, when the correct answer is 25. Asked what percentage of Republicans earn more than $250,000, and the response from Democrats was 38%, when in truth it's 2%. Pretty big discrepancies. Our guest Perry Bacon wrote about this study in his 538 column called Secret Identity, and it's about how identity intersects with politics and policies. He's a senior writer at 538, and he joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Perry Bacon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what does the study reveal?
It reveals that in the head, the study is titled The Parties in Our Heads. And it basically reveals that the parties in our heads are not the parties in real life. And as you indicated, Democrats think the Republican Party is full of pretty wealthy people, and that's not true. Democrats tend to overstate the number of Southerners and evangelicals in the Republican Party, versus Republicans overstate the number of blacks, atheists, people who are LGBT, people who are union members. Those are the things that the authors tested, those ideas or those demographics. So I think it overall tells us that we have stereotypes. You know, we know we have lots of deep partisanship and what is called negative partisanship, meaning you are a Democrat not because you like Democrats, because you hate Republicans so much. So we have negative partisanship already, but it seems to be negative partisanship built in some ways on misinformation.
Well, it sounds like not only do we not know each other, but then we exaggerate the differences that we think exist on the other side.
Exactly. And I think part of this is what I would say is some amount of innumeracy in the electorate broadly. And what I mean by that is it's true that most blacks are Democrats, an overwhelming amount, or they vote for Democrats. That said, most Democrats are not black. Those are two, you know, most blacks are Democrats, but most Democrats are not black.
Right.
I think it's a concept people don't necessarily understand.
Well, and in fact, you wrote, just to underscore what we're talking about, the Republicans thought that 38% of Democrats were gay, lesbian, or bisexual, when in actual fact, it's 6%. So the thought that 38% of the Democratic Party is LGBTQ is a pretty large exaggeration or misconception.
Considering how big of a number, that's a much larger than people overall in the population who are LGBTs. But it goes to the point that, you know, we've had big debates in the country. You know, this is probably partly a media problem. Like, the media tends to cover every 4 years, will Republican X win because evangelicals will show up at these numbers, or will Democrat win because blacks will show up in big numbers? I think part of that is people's perceptions of the parties are shaped by press coverage.
Well, and the way we divide the country into red or blue states.
Exactly, right.
Knowing, of course, there is, Pennsylvania is a very good example of that, a lot of diversity within the state.
Right. One thing that I would say if I was, in charge of media coverage writ large,
right.
And there was a Pew poll yesterday that showed this as well, is that about 63% of the people who voted for Donald Trump are whites who did not get college degrees, 63%. But that leaves a big – but I feel like if you read the media coverage, it's like everybody is like that. But in reality, there are – you know, if you go to suburban Philadelphia, you go to suburban Atlanta, you go to suburban Louisville, Kentucky, you will find plenty of Republicans who don't fit the sort of they say, you know, sort of unsophisticated things. They say somewhat racist things at times. You can find plenty of people who are – you know, if you don't have to – if you're a reporter in Washington, you don't have to go to Alabama to find Trump supporters. You can drive to Pennsylvania, or you can even drive to suburban D.C. and find plenty of Trump voters.
Is it just that the media, again, writ large or broadly speaking, just uses these and trades and works in these stereotypes as well? It's just easier to understand the country that way?
I think there was a perception after the election that we missed the Trump rise. And I think that was true, is that we missed that Trump was going to beat Rubio and Bush and so on, and that then Trump beat Hillary. But I think that's been almost overinterpreted. In reality, most people who voted for Donald Trump didn't vote for him because of his promises on health care or on the Muslim ban or even – but they voted for him because they're Republicans. And, like, you know, most people who voted for Trump voted for Mitt Romney and John McCain. Most people who voted for Obama voted for Hillary Clinton. I think sometimes we over-personalize politics and under-personalize, under-understand how deep and deep and enduring partisanship is.
But do you think there's anything different from that? I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, I have to say, Barry. But certainly I remember growing up and there were families that, you know, they voted Republican because that's what mom did and grandmom did and grandpop did, and going back in generations. And same for Democrats, that there was a kind of identity associated with a political party.
I mean, that is still true. I just think there's not a lot of swinging based on that. It's like, yes, that's in part, I don't think it disagrees with my point, that reinforces it. It's like that you vote Republican not because of, like, Mitt Romney and Donald Trump are very different people, to the point where during the campaign, Mitt Romney said, don't vote for Donald Trump, he's terrible. But still, all the voters did, which goes to the point that, like, the parties are changing, I would argue. Like, the George W. Bush party is not the Donald Trump party. So voters had two choices, particularly Republicans, there's been more of a change in that party's ideology, I would say. The Democrats have changes too, but you either could change parties or you could change your views. And what we've seen in a lot of polls, for example, is Republicans' views on Russia are much more positive than they used to be. And I think that's because they were given a choice. You know, Donald Trump has more positive views on Russia than Ronald Reagan or George Bush did. And you can either change parties, you can change views. And I think you're seeing evidence. And you saw it on the Democratic side a little bit too. And, like, for example, there was some data that suggested that African Americans were somewhat leery about same-sex marriage in polls in like 2008 or so. Once Obama endorsed same-sex marriage, what you saw was not blacks breaking from him, but instead blacks who like Obama going toward being more supportive of same-sex marriage.
Let me go back to this Pew Research Center. Almost 20% of black men voted for Trump. I thought that was interesting, and almost no black women did. Perry, does that tell us something significant?
I mean, yes and no. We've sort of knew already that black men are a little bit more conservative or more Republican than black women. But I think that gap was, I think it was 81% of black men and 98% of black women. And these are sort of small sample sizes. But I do think if you notice the events Trump has and the things he does, it seems like I'm thinking of Kanye West as an example offhand here. But I do think there are more prominent black male figures that want to associate with the president, because I think it is capturing to some extent that women, you're seeing a gender gap among all races where women, even among Republicans, where women have much more unfavorable views about Trump than men do.
Do you think, though, that the parties are losing that middle? There used to be the blue Democrats. I don't know if they still exist or not. And the centrist Republicans, you mentioned George W. Bush. Do you think that the two parties are just going in opposite directions and the middle is there's less middle there?
Yeah, I mean, I would pick an issue, maybe not middle in the electorate, but I would say middle in the elected representatives. So there used to be a fair amount of pro-life Democrats in Congress and a fair amount of pro-choice Republicans in Congress. And that makes sense because there was some data earlier in the year that showed about 1 in 3 Republicans is pro-choice and about 1 in 5 Democrats is pro-life. So there's some mixing in the electorate. There's some centrism in the electorate there. But in terms of the parties, there are I think there's going to be, at the end of this year, this election, there will be no pro-choice Republicans in the House. And there are very few pro-life Democrats left either. And I think that goes to the fact that I'm not sure that I think there is a fair amount of centrism and mixes of views in the electorate. I just don't think that's, but I think the way the parties screen out candidates and the way the parties, like, you think about how Trump kind of ran as kind of an unconventional populist Republican. He talked about, I'm going to have a more generous health care plan than Barack Obama will. Barack Obama did. When he got to Congress, he got to Washington, the Republican Party, Paul Ryan particularly, the Freedom Caucus has pushed him toward fairly conservative views. And I think Trump is now, in many ways, governing this way Ted Cruz would have.
How much do you think animus, even hatred, defines parties so that Democrats would say, I'm a Democrat because I hate Donald Trump, or you've got Republicans saying, I'm a Republican because I hate Hillary Clinton or I hated Barack Obama?
I think the Pew data suggests most people still vote, like, you know, something like 60-40. Most people are still in their party because they agree with their party, but there's a 35-40% that's more motivated by negative partisanship. So I think it's still a mix, but that negative partisanship number is growing.
Why do you think it's growing?
I think, this is something I haven't studied as much. I suspect it's a little bit of part of the political culture we're in now, which is that politics is broadly viewed as negative. It's like the ratings of Congress are lower than ever. They're always low, but they're really low. It's like become one of the things where people don't, I think there's been a demonization of politics sort of writ large, that politicians are all corrupt and politics doesn't work and politics is broken. And I think that to some extent Obama sort of campaigned against Congress and Washington in 2008, and then Donald Trump did the same thing in 2016. And I mean, in reality, I mean, I don't want to seem Pollyannish, but most members of Congress actually are not embezzling money. I mean, there are a few of them, but there's it must be said, you know, yes, they are not all thieves. I mean, you know, right. So
Let me read a couple of comments. We have one from Facebook from Frank, says, one wonders what our democracy would be like if candidates ran as themselves with no party affiliation on issues and their own personal platform. And it's interesting to think about that, knowing that the independence that those people are growing. I don't know when it comes to voting, whether they line up the way they used to. But nonetheless, there is this group in the middle that is unaffiliated. What do you think about that, Perry?
So what we find is the number of people who are independents is really high. It's like 40%, but doesn't really tell us much, because most of those independents, when we look at the data, actually tend to vote with one party or another. I think it's like they don't want to say they're Democrats, but they really just vote for every Democrat. So that doesn't the number of swing voters is more like 10%. It's a much lower number for the national election. But I would say, even though we talk about intense polarization at the national level, and that's true, you can see some movement, because, you know, I live here in D.C. In the Maryland governor's race, which I'm following because I happen to be locally here, the Democrat Ben Jealous is really struggling in the governor's race, because Larry Hogan is the sort of moderate Republican here. A lot of Democrats kind of like him. He's fairly centrist. He's kind of anti-Trump. You go to Massachusetts, the most popular politician in America by polls is Charlie Baker. He's the Republican governor of Massachusetts, which, you know, is the home of Elizabeth Warren and Ted Kennedy and so on. So I do think there, when you get out of, like, the national issues are very, very polarizing. When you get out of that a little bit, I don't think the solution necessarily is we shouldn't have parties. I think parties do serve a function. I wonder if we should have, like, somebody I would do some work with named Lee Drutman. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation. He writes a lot about the idea that there should be more parties, and we should have something called ranked choice voting. And if you had three or four parties, it would become, like, in theory, I think right now in the country, we basically have four parties to some extent. You have sort of a Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, one party. You have a Hillary Clinton party or a Barack Obama party. I think that's the second party. You have a kind of a John Huntsman, Jeb Bush party, I'd say, is the third party. And then you have Donald Trump and the Republicans, the fourth party.
Well, hold on to that thought, Perry, because we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. That's Perry Bacon. He's a senior writer at 538. In fact, his column is called Secret Identity, and it is about how identity intersects with politics and policies. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Perry Bacon from 538 about political misperceptions, why Republicans and Democrats don't really understand each other very well. Also, why people choose one party over another and what these misconceptions say about the modern political landscape. And again, Perry writes the Secret Identity column for 538. And a couple of comments here, radiotimes at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation, and interested in how you define your politics. Perry, picking up on something you said right before the break about ranked choice voting, a Facebook comment from John who says, there are also more than two parties. We're too polar, and these days it seems like you're only allowed to be one or the other. Are things changing?
I don't see a lot of evidence of that, because it's right now, because of the system we have now, there's not any way to, let's say you're uncomfortable with the way Donald Trump talks about race, but you are adamantly pro-life. There's not a place for you to go. If you vote for Evan McMullen or some third-party person, you're basically helping Hillary Clinton win, and that is against your policy view. So right now, I don't think there's a great place for that. I think that we need to have electoral system changes like ranked choice voting before we have, like, you know, I think this idea that a Michael Bloomberg-style person can just raise a lot of money, I mean, it did happen in France. That's how Macron won. So it's not impossible to sort of create a new party out of nothing. But I don't think it's happening in America right now. I think Ross Perot tried that. I think Bloomberg's explored it. It's just really hard to do that. In fact, whatever you think about Donald Trump, I think one of the smart things he did was, instead of running as independent, was to be running the Republican primary, because it gives you lots of advantages.
Well, talking about this ranked choice voting, so listeners understand, it's whoever the top vote getters in a primary, then go head-to-head for the general election?
That's some sort systems. Some of them are just basically let's say we had an election in America in 2016. You'd have a choice between, you could rank, you know, let's say you're sort of a centrist-y person. You rank Jeb Bush first, Hillary Clinton second, Bernie Sanders third, Donald Trump fourth. And so at that point, we narrow the voting choices that way. So who you rank matters. And at the end, we sort of assess who wins based on that, as opposed to one person, one vote only, in the way we do it now. So essentially, that would reward, I assume a lot of people would have Trump or Bernie Sanders as their fourth choice. And so to some extent, you might end up with the first choice as someone probably like Hillary or Jeb Bush.
In that, it ends up kind of moderating the more, I won't say extreme, but votes on the edges?
That, and I think more importantly, it gives you a choice of more than two.
What do you make of the fact that there are some Democratic socialists who are doing pretty well within the Democratic Party, at least when it comes to primary elections? What do you think that tells us?
I think there's a natural energy on the – I think you're seeing that there was a energy on the – I think it was analogous a little bit to the Tea Party in 2009, 2010. There was a Republican establishment, and there were people to the right of it who felt like they were not being heard, and they ran in primaries, and often they won. But more importantly, what you saw with the Tea Party, and I think you're seeing this with the Socialists and the more left and the Democratic Party too, is even if you lose a primary, if you force the other person to take a lot of your positions, then you're winning in a certain way as well. Hillary Clinton beat Bernie Sanders, but she had to basically adopt a free college plan that she was mocking at the beginning along the way. And so I think that is that's the power of theirs. And I also think that in the Democratic Party, I think a lot of the Democrats felt like they were being centrist to win the election. Hmm. And then they lost the election, but not just lost it, but they lost it to a person proposing a Muslim ban. So at that point, it was kind of like, oh, well, do the voters really care about, you know, being moderate in the first place? Or is that really what we need to do? So I do think there's more of, like, you know, the losing in some ways has kind of expanded the window of what Democrats will take. There's one view where Democrats should have been probably less risky. You could imagine Joe Biden saying, we lost because we went too far left and we need to be more toward the middle. But I think what you're really seeing is people on the Democratic side saying, Donald Trump won and he wasn't really saying moderate stuff. So why don't we have our own kind of what we really believe and say that out loud? Like, I wrote a piece about Kamala Harris a few days ago, and I think she's doing that right now, in fact.
Well, that's so interesting, because I think the game plan used to be in primaries, you'd run towards the edges, and then for the general election, you go back towards the middle, to that centrist middle. And you're saying, obviously, it didn't work for the Democrats, and so now there's some rethinking going on.
It depends on where you are. Like, you know, like the guy who won in that Pennsylvania special election, Connor Lamb, right. I would argue he's fairly centrist and ran that way. Doug Jones in Alabama ran as a fairly centrist person. But you also have candidates who are more to the left. Like, I think the woman who won, Whitmer, who won the nomination for governor in Michigan the other night, she was not as left as the Bernie Sanders candidate, but she was pretty left. And so I do think you're seeing different methods of a running. And I think it depends on, obviously, where you're running. So if you're running in North Dakota, it's different than running in Wisconsin, which is different than running in Michigan, which is different than running in, you know, like in New York City, it's easy to run as a liberal. But I do think However the Democrats approach 2018, 2020 is different because they have to pick one person to run for the entire country, and that will have a choice between do you want a Joe Biden or do you want a Bernie Sanders.
A Facebook comment from Elisa. Currently, I would say it's about region more than anything else, cities versus smaller towns when it comes to this political or partisan divide. Perry, how important do you think region is?
I mean,
and maybe it depends on the region, right?
Well, I think that, you know, we do have an urban, we are increasingly having an, so the Pew data showed, because most people live in areas that are suburban, then most, the parties both are mostly suburban people. That said, the Republican Party has a big lean toward, much more lean toward rural, and the Democratic Party has much more lean toward urban. So there is a urban, there's an urban rural divide. There's a college, non-college divide. And obviously there's a white, non-white divide. The Pew data showed, for example, Hillary's voters were about 60% white and about 40% non-white. Trump's voters about 88% white and about 12% non-white. So I think that, so urban, non-urban sort of codes racially too. So I think that is a more important cleavage, honestly.
What about religion? What role do you think that plays?
So we know that religion at this point is a dividing line, but it's not changing that much. I mean, in the sense that, well, I guess it's changing in one way, is that the number of people who are identify themselves as sort of what we call nuns, they're not necessarily atheists, but they don't affiliate with a religion, is growing largely. And those people, though, are mostly in the Democratic Party. So it's not as if that's causing the change parties, but the Democratic Party has a bigger sort of non-religious element than it used to. That said, the majority of Democrats are Christians, so it's not as if that's a sort of a total radical wing there either. The data from 2016 shows what we already know, which is that white evangelicals stuck with Trump. He's a Republican, even if he was not necessarily the most churchy Republican. And then there was a split among the Catholic vote among whites, and then Hispanic Catholics were overwhelmingly for Hillary, Black Protestants overwhelmingly for Hillary. So to some extent, the religious vote, I think, captures a lot that's already captured by other data.
A tweet from Lou says, what is the purpose of the party? There's a basic question.
The purpose of
the party.
So the party helps you build a coalition, helps you win. So in some ways, so the party is organizing in local and state races. So if you join the party, it has certain values in it. It also helps you win, helps you raise money. So when you're Donald Trump, if you're just like, you're a rich businessman, so you have some, well, you know, we can debate how rich he is, but
yeah, we don't know the answer to that, actually.
Yeah, but let's say he has money, or Mitt Romney, let's say, is certainly a rich person. So Mitt Romney was a rich person, so he could have run as independent, but when you're the Republican nominee, you have state parties, local parties, the national party. You have money behind you. You have a huge brand behind you. So the parties have a big, you know, are very helpful to you. They have like a list of people every 4 years, every 2 years who volunteer for the Republicans. That's a great brand. So a lot of people vote based on parties. So if you're Mitt Romney, who, you know, his views, he used to live in Massachusetts and Utah and so on, but you're the Republican nominee. So people sort of assume that you are opposed to abortion rights, for example. So if they have that view, they're going to be more likely before you. They assume you're for low taxes. Like, having a party benefits politicians a lot. How does it benefit rank and file voters? It does benefit in one way, which is that people don't have time. People are busy. They don't have time necessarily to read about, like, if we're talking about president is one thing, but city council, mayor, you may not really know or care that much. I think you should, but you may not know that much about the people running. So D versus R does give you some clue to something, but I worry it's becoming too much of a clue to too many things.
And that's Perry Bacon. He writes the Secret Identity column for 538. And again, it looks at how identity intersects with politics and policies. And you can join us. Any questions or comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How much, Perry, though, do you think Donald Trump has turned the Republican Party on its head? And I'm thinking about tariffs and some of the other policies that he has endorsed as president that are really the sort of opposite of what the traditional Republican Party has stood for.
So I would say there are three issues where Donald Trump has changed the Republican Party. So I would say tariffs and trade policy, where he's a 180 difference from what George Bush or previous Republicans were. I would say on immigration, where George Bush basically supported legalization for undocumented people, and Trump adamantly opposes that. So immigration, he's moved the party way right. Trade, I don't know if that's left or right, but he's moved it a lot. And then on what I would call sort of norms, meaning like, what have you thought about George Bush? He didn't call the press the enemy of the state very regularly. And so you're seeing this, bleed down, where now when I cover races, the governor of Kentucky regularly attacks the press in the same way Trump does. And so I do think those with the race, he's changed the party. That said, if you look at his, I think we sort of overcover him in a certain way in terms of policy. If you look at, the tax bill, the health care bill, the Supreme Court nominees, Donald Trump's basic job is to do what Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell say to do. He signs stuff. That's like on the big initiatives of the year, of the last 2 years on policy, beyond those three areas, which I'm not saying are not important. But in general, his cabinet is Republican people. And I think that's an important. So I should mention foreign policy, NATO, Russia. Obviously, I should have mentioned those.
Yeah, I was going to say
places
right.
where he's broken. And I think his cabinet, and I think you've seen the cabinet tension on that. So obviously, and those are, it's a hugely important field I left out. But I would say it's a balance. It's not, Trump has certainly changed the party in some important ways, but the party is also imposed on Trump in some important ways too, where basically his list of judges is written by the Federal Society and approved by Mitch McConnell, and he says, okay, does he know much about Neil Gorsuch? I don't think so.
Let's talk about Kamala Harris. You mentioned her, and you did a story about her in 538, and some interesting comparisons between her and Barack Obama. How do you see those differences? And he, of course, before he was president, talked, and even as president, saying, we are one America, we're not a red America, we're not a blue America. How do you compare the two of them?
So what I was trying to show was that I would argue when Obama became famous for this 2004 speech, as you noted, there's no such thing as a red America, a blue America, a very optimistic style speech. And this is how he kind of ran on 2008, basically saying the divides we think we have are not as strong as maybe they are. And I don't and Harris, on the other hand, has been leaned much more into there is racism, there is homophobia, there is, she would not give a speech like that today. And she's an African American.
I wonder whether
person.
Obama would give a speech like that today.
And I said in the story, actually, I think that it's, I'm not, Kamala Harris and Barack Obama are obviously different people, so that's important. But I think the key factor here is the context is really different about, even if you're, I think it would be hard to stand up today in America if you're a black or white or whatever race and say there's no such thing as a black America, or it would seem like insane. Like Obama's racial optimism, I think, and his sort of cultural optimism and sort of unification view of the world does not look like what happened. It looks like he, I'm not going to say he didn't unify the countries. I wouldn't say that's anybody's job, but the country has divides and those persist in his term. Donald Trump won, and Donald Trump's not even trying to unify anybody, I wouldn't say. And so in that context, I think Kamala Harris is a black candidate, but I don't think she will run the way that Barack Obama does, she chooses to run, because I don't think that path, the sort of what I call the sort of kumbaya strategy, I don't think that's possible anymore.
Let me get Molly from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Molly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I just had a comment about ranked choice voting.
Yes, go ahead.
In Minneapolis, Minnesota, Ginger Jensen ran independent of the Democratic and Republican parties as a socialist candidate under the banner of Socialist Alternative. She won in the first round of ranked choice, and in a normal election, she would have taken it. But because of the financial and sort of dominant power that the Democratic Party has, they were able to throw up multiple candidates. And what happened was a sort of second choice candidate that wasn't dominating at all in terms of people's first choice for who would be city councilor ended up winning. And so I think that really speaks to both the sort of diverse opinions that sort of fall under the Democratic Party and how it doesn't necessarily mean anything in terms of policy, but also even in sort of a ranked choice system, they could throw up multiple candidates because they have the money and power to support multiple candidate races and wash out
I hear you. I hear you.
Offensive campaign that people want.
Sure. No, I appreciate the call, Molly. Perry, anything you want to say in response?
I mean, I guess I would probably suggest that people, when given ranked choices, are going to end up probably going toward a more centrist-y kind of candidate. I think that's the thing that is sort of the natural. I'm leery of the sort of the Democratic Party dominated this or this. Like, people have the choice to vote, and my guess is in most cases they will often move toward what they perceive as a more sort of in the middle candidate who has a broader appeal. Like I said, if we had a 4-person Trump, Sanders, Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton race, my guess is, a Jeb Bush or Hillary would win. I think that's probably where we're headed.
Here's a question from John. Do you think Democrats are more quick to try and extend an olive branch to the Republicans that doesn't get reciprocated? Is one party quicker to demonize than the other? What do you think, Perry?
That's a hard one. I mean, I think that you could argue pretty well in 2010 and 11, Obama tried a lot of compromises with the, and probably 2009, 2012, I'd say Obama tried a lot of compromises with Republicans that were not reciprocated. And I think people in Washington at the time were like, you know, arguing he was kind of naive for trying that. Maybe he had to try it, or maybe he should have tried it, but it didn't work. And versus, I don't think Trump has really tried to work with Democrats that much. And in terms of rhetoric, it's hard to say that Obama may have said some critical things. I don't think he suggested George Bush wasn't born in the United States or anything. So, I mean, if you think of the standard bearers of the parties, Trump lies a lot more and lies about more sort of aggressive things than Obama did. But I'm not sure I would say, and I think that Fox News is more partisan than I would say MSNBC. So I do think there are some differences, but I would say there is more kind of like of the extreme demonization on the right now, but there's certainly some demonization on the left too.
Well, Perry Bacon, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And that's Perry Bacon. And he writes the 538 column called Secret Identity. It's about how identity intersects with politics and policies. And he's a senior writer at 538. We're going to take a very short break. And then we will be talking about the Manafort trial and talking with Rosalind Helderman, who's a reporter for The Washington Post. Stay with us. We'll be right back.